Well, thank you so much for coming and joining here in this beautiful, beautiful afternoon. I do appreciate the fact that that sun out there and how beautiful it is, for you have to have taken time out to come and talk about death and dying. So I do appreciate your time very much. Well, what we talked about, for those of folks who haven't been in our conversation before, but what we talked about before were, in some ways, were about near-death experiences, those kinds of experiences that people have when they come right to the edge of life, and then about hope and dignity, and about how those things shape death and dying. And today, kind of in the middle, we'll talk about death itself. What is death? How do we experience it in different ways? And then tomorrow there's a break, but then on Friday the conversation will be about grieving, great grief process. There's some really fine work that's been done in the last 15, 20 years on grief theory and how we approach grief. That's been really, really helpful. And so we'll spend time talking about that. And then on Saturday, the last one is talking about advanced direct medical directives, healthcare directives, what they are, why they don't work very well, and how we can get them to work. We can work on them so that they do work better. Of course, what we want. So I'd like to start. I'd like to begin this session with a prayer for y'all. Dear Lord, before the beginning thou hast foreknown the end. Before the birthday, the deathbed was seen by you. Cleanse what cannot be cleansed. Mend what I cannot mend, O Lord. O merciful, be merciful to me. While the end is drawing near, I know not my own end. Birth, I do not recall. My death I cannot foresee. O God, arise to defend, arise to befriend. O merciful Lord, be merciful to me. Amen. That's written by Christine Rossetti. I hope to use some, again, as in other ones, if you have a story, if you have something that I'm talking about rings a bell and you'd like to share that information, please raise your hand, get that out there, bring those questions forward. I tend to get going and have a lot more information than we could share in an hour, so once I get going on, I get really focused in on it and not stop to ask those questions. So if you're thinking of something or something I say doesn't fit, or if you have an idea that could expand it in any way, please feel free to let me know, engage me in it, okay? Just to start out, this quote I just put up because whenever in the process of talking about death and dying, it has been my personal experience that when I am doing ministry, when I'm working with people, that there's always is that point where my anxiety is up. I don't know what's going on. We can't figure out how to really do this. Of course, there's a few that come in and everything just goes really well, and you say, this is the perfect family. I hope my family's like this. And there's once in a while. Most of the time, though, whenever I've been involved with families where somebody's coming to the end of life, it's a very complicated process. There's a lot going on. And this quote actually has been helpful for me to keep this in mind. We, especially in healthcare and medicine, our goal is always to save, extend, and cure. We do it, and we do it very well, very, very well. In fact, you know, my dad is still here because of that, because they are very precise, and people know exactly what they're doing. He had a heart problem, went in for bypass surgery, ended up having triple bypass surgery, got an infection in his chest, almost lost his sternum, had those little newest fangled beads in there to fight the infection. It was just amazing all the how much they controlled things and got it done to help get him through, right? Our dying associate by our healthcare system is associated by our own sense of being able to affect and change things in the world. But at this point, I kind of keep it in the back of my head. Ultimately, it's hard, it's uncertain, and even when people die very well, there's almost always a sense of you're not sure, there's the uncertainty. So I just kind of hold that. But I want to actually, I'm going to interrupt this because there's way too long for me to write during what the talk you're having. So I had to throw up this early. If I guys simply pass out these sheets, I might. There's about 20 of them, and it looks like we're maybe a little over 20. So, people could share once a little bit. Death, as you're passing out, death is, death and dying are completely and utterly ordinary and common things. They are, approximately 240,000 people die per month. 240,000 people die a month. I mean, that's excluding a huge major disasters. So every year about 2.8 million people die. So, of course, the number of people who have died is phenomenally large.
Is that the U.S. or the world?
No, it's the world. That's the world. So that it's just an ordinary common, it's as common as birth. People die. It is a completely predictable, unpredictable thing. I mean, about 60% of us will die with some sense of it's coming on the way. I have cancer, pancreatic cancer, and about 40% of us won't see it coming. I have pancreatic cancer and something else happened, there's a car accident and I died before. Or unexpectedly, we don't see it coming. Okay? Or even those, I should say, probably heart disease is a better one. People who have prolonged illness are expecting to die of heart disease, but they die of something else along the way. Old Elena joke, you got time for one?
Sure.
Oh, thank you for saying yes. Somebody thank you for saying yes. Old Elena, they're pretty conservative folks. They don't do a lot. And outside of just every Friday, they would go down to the corner gas station. It's the 7-Eleven now, and they'd buy one lottery ticket. Just Minnesota, it's in Minnesota. They buy one lottery ticket. That was all. That was their big night out. So they'd go down and they'd buy the bread and the eggs and the milk for the weekend, and then they'd buy the lottery ticket. And when they got back one Friday, Lena was going through the groceries and said, "Oli, we forgot to buy our lottery." She said, "We bought the lottery ticket, but we forgot to buy the eggs and the milk." That's pretty exciting. So so Oli decided that he'd better go back. So he turns around and walks back down to get the milk. And about that time, Lena turns on the television and the lottery comes up. And believe it or not, they won $11.2 million. $11.2 million. There was the ticket. Lena was so excited. And then she remembered Oli's heart condition. Wasn't supposed to get too excited. So what would Lena do? Of course, she didn't know what to do. So what'd she do? She called the pastor. Of course, the first thing, Pastor, you gotta come over here. We just won $11.2 million. Well, that's great, Lena. But I tell you, Oli's heart condition, I don't know what to do. Well, he said, all you have to do is just take your time, all right? Oh, I'd be glad to do that. Will you come over, Pastor, please? Oh, sure, I'll be over. So, Pastor comes right over, and Oli comes back and sees the pastor sitting in the parlor.
Oh.
Yeah, we still have parlors in Minnesota, and Oli, in the parlor. And Oli says, "Lena, why is the pastor here? What's wrong?" And Lena said, "Bill, I don't know how to tell you this, Oli, but Bill, Oli, all I can do, we just won $11.2 million in the lottery." And Oli said, "Lena, that's great. Lena says, "Well, what are you going to do with it?" He said, "Well, we'll give half of it to the church." And the pastor dropped over dead. Yeah, unexpected, expected. The other thing about that is that it is permanent and unchangeable. And I know these things sound very like stuff, right? Permanent, unchangeable. We don't really think about the whole thing, the reality of what death is. It is truly and completely stress-free existence. Stress keeps us alive. It's what your heart does, right? It keeps the blood flowing through your body. Stress, when death happens, there is no hearing, there is no speaking, there is no feeling, there is no strength, there is no smell. I don't know how many times, whenever I've been with a family, and they have had to literally move the person who's dying, that almost always they say, it was so heavy, or there was no help. They didn't, how did we do it? It was so clumsy. Because almost always, we're used to when we move somebody to have them help, respond, move. There's life in that body. We feel the life. But people talk about how odd it is to move a body that has no life in it anymore. And death, so death is, one of the things it is it's a physical reality. And that's mediated by whether I have cancer, whether it's an automobile accident, all of those things bring that about. But it's physical. The second thing it is, death is cultural. What I mean is, it's shaped by our culture. Some of the oldest known human gatherings are around death and dying. I mean, a skeleton found in northern Iraq, estimated about 10,000 years, it's in a grave, it's got pollen around it, so there was some kind of flowers, it's got tools laid inside. I mean, when we human beings started organizing ourselves, getting ourselves together, we had funerals right away. And FYI, whenever I'm doing a funeral and somebody says, oh, we don't want flowers or anything like that, I always think in my head, that's breaking a tradition that goes a long way back. We have all, the sense of what do we do with the death, this body of the dead, how do we reverence it, what's it like? It's been a part of our culture on and on and on. I don't want to be embalmed. I don't want that. That's such a modern thing. Well, the Egyptians were really good at it. There's been a lot of cultures along the way for thousands of years that really knew how to do that kind of, those kinds of things. It's been shaped in our culture all along. In 1860s, the Civil War reshaped death and dying. Photography has really shaped death and dying. Photography got its start. I mean, it's real, launched during the Civil War. And, we've seen those pictures of the soldiers and the young men with the soldiers and their uniforms and stuff. Well, a lot of those pictures, they took those pictures and they sent them home because they had a pretty good idea that they wouldn't be getting back home. And then a lot of photographs were taken of pictures and later bodies were identified out of those pictures. If you've seen some of the Civil War pictures, they're gruesome. They're just gruesome. Partly photography was just getting going. There weren't any rules. People didn't know you were supposed to smile in pictures. Those pictures were taken. A lot of them were sent back to the old country. One photograph I remember very particularly, it's a photograph of a young family with there's three kids. Looking into the camera, beautiful background set, and then there's one that's sleeping right in front, and you look at it and then you realize it's because the smallest one had died, so they took a family photo of the living children with the dead child there. Okay. Now, for most of us in our day and age, we say there's something wrong with that, right? And you think kind of well. that's because death, of the way death was looked at that time. It's different than how we definitely look at now. But that's what Photographs did. You took the picture and then you sent it on. I've got a family photo at home of my uncle, John, who was killed in World War One, and his body came back. And so then we have pictures of the funeral and all of his casket, all of that stuff was done so that they could pass on those memories. But it's really, our death is really shaped by those kinds of experiences. In our day and age, death is shaped, one of the primary shapers of death is the medical community. We have medicalized death. For centuries, and for our grandparents, death was basically common sense. You know, person stops breathing, they're laying there, and you take a mirror, right? You put it up their mouth like this, nothing shows up here, they've died. Why do you wait 3 days? Because sometimes people would wake up. So you want to make sure that they were dead. So you'd wait. One of the reasons you waited for a while was just so that you were sure. I mean, in fact, in England, for a while, they actually would bury people with a string tied around their finger, which with a cord that ran up to the surface with a bell on it. You heard for whom the bell tolls? Mm-hmm. Well, if I wake up in that casket, ding, 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 I can ring that bell and people can come get me. Now, they did that because it happened. It happened. So they wanted to make sure that they would have. I've kind of a parallel in some ways. If you think now about our time, where is it that we have kind of the same kind of thing? Cords attached to us, waiting, hoping. You can think of a hospital, think of an intensive care unit, all those cords and bells in there, hoping that the bell will start ringing and that they'll wake up. But still, it's the sense that death has always been something that has been shaped by the way we live our lives. Death is one of those things, death is so final and so complete that we have to shape it by our looking at it. We have to figure out how to meet it and how to define it, because there's no other way to do it. In our day and age, death has become medicalized. What I say about that is we have cardiac death and we have brain death. We needed to define what is dying. The reason we have brain death is because we have organ donations. If we didn't have the ability to harvest organs, we wouldn't need the definition of brain death. That brain death comes so that we might be able to harvest organs from cadavers, from people who have died. Okay? So we shape, even the very act of death itself, we shape by the way our culture looks and looks at what it means. In our culture, this is almost completely flip-flop from just 75 to 100 years ago. 75% of the deaths will happen in an institution, either in a hospital or in a nursing home or some kind of hospice house, something like that. About 75% of people will die there. About 21% will die either at home or, remember that 40% I said of unexpected deaths? In accidents, in some way, outside of the institution. It didn't used to be that way. It used to be that people, when they got very sick, would be at home, would die at home. I'd like to read you a quote. This quote is written by a physician, Joanna Lynn. Comes from the Annals of Internal Medicine, and it just captures for me so well that sense of how death and our death is shaped by the culture in which we live. Okay? Since the turn of the century, the usual time course and cause of death has changed dramatically. At that time, physicians could do little to alter the rapid fatal course of infectious diseases and injury. The risk of death was almost equal in every decade after the first year of life. Either cancer or heart disease appeared suddenly and killed quickly. Tuberculosis killed slowly, but its infection led patients were excluded from the mainstream of life. So almost all the illnesses killed people very quickly. Excuse me for that reading. Today, she writes, most persons will live for months, if not years, with illnesses that result from in their death. Most die when they are old. Dying has become a gradual period of deterioration. And other once familiar boundaries between being sick and dying have become obscured. The final common pathway of disability and decline makes establishing causes and correcting physiology less important than maintaining function and mitigating spiritual, social, and emotional needs. So the dying used to be something that happened in funeral parlors at home. I mean, not funeral parlors. After death, you'd go to a funeral home, which was somebody's home, and would often be in, the family might wash the body, take care of the body. That was in the 1930s. That happened. That was very common. Okay? Now, someone dies in the hospital. Body's taken to a funeral, mortuary, excuse me. And the body's taken care of there. In the hospital, the nursing staff will often wash the body and take care of the body in preparation for the family that's coming. So we really approach it in very different ways. You actually can't die in this country without a cause of death. And old age doesn't work. Right? You have to, if you die, you have to have a death certificate which says your cause of death on it. And old age doesn't work. They have to say that they have to be specific. There has to be a medical reason on that. The medicalization of death has really shaped a lot of the way we die. And one of the struggles that we have is that death used to be something that was more of a family affair, was more like something that happened within the context of family. Now it's become more, in a way, a professional affair. So many people feel much less able to know how to respond or what to do when somebody becomes ill, because we're so used to turning towards the professionals and asking them, what do we do? How do we do it next? Okay.
Can I ask you a little question?
Shoot.
Now you were talking about how it used to be that the family would wash the body.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any movement back towards opening that up as a possibility? I mean, is that something that can even happen, or is it something
sure.
that it's sort of people just have taken it away and it's not even a possibility anymore?
Sure, no, it's really, there's, the hospice movement is really a part of, is a big part of that
okay.
move back towards the sense that we have a part in dying process. That families and people really are actively involved in it. Hospice movement started, yes, and there are more and more. And it's a growing palliative care movement within hospitals to provide that opportunity for people more and more to address the suffering that people are experiencing in. And that really, those kinds of things are happening more and more. And it's really cultural, it really depends on the culture a lot too,
mm-hmm.
how much those happen. People, but it's a, again, it's so dramatic because we need to, we feel we need to ask permission, permission to do those kinds of things. That's how much we have been trained to believe that death is something for the experts to tell us about.
It's almost like when somebody dies and it's not my spouse anymore, it's their thing to.
It's much like there's some similarities between that and birth. How birth is really something that we want to be involved with. You know, I'm the dad, how can I be involved with this birth and be there and have the experts really help guide and be there right when they need to, and then step back away as soon as they can. And there are many people who are asking that question about death. How can we be involved with it? So that I just wanted, that's kind of the first part, is to kind of just walk through a little bit of that and just explain a little bit of that. Set it up in the context of when all of us approach death, we will approach it partly from the reality of the physical illness that we have, will help shape how we see death going on, partly out of the medical experience, medical community will help shape it, and partly just out of our own personal experiences. So I want to get to that a person went, but just asking, what are the names for death that you've all heard?
Kill the bucket.
Oh yeah, I like that one.
Pass down.
Take
over. Pushing up daisies. Pass away. Gone home.
Oh yeah. Gone home.
Meet our maker.
Gone home, yeah, right. Meet the maker. Meet. I missed some in there. Any other ones? I missed some of them that you said. Meet maker, gone home, passed over.
Demise.
Any heard this one?
Expired.
That's a medical term.
It is. I was working in a hospital. I was officially called a very nice title. A medical X-ray transport technician, I think. I filed X-rays for a while in the hospital, and I found one that said expired on it. And I asked him, what does this mean, expired? He said, well, the person died. I was like, expired? Any other ones?
No, deceased.
Yeah, deceased.
If you read the obituaries, as I do more and more, and you get all the gone fishing and, gone golfing or...
Right.
Something they like to do in life.
Uh-huh.
How about croaked?
Croaked. Yeah. Pushing up daisies.
You got that one?
Pushing up daisies. Yeah.
Passed on.
Or passed away.
Yeah, passed on or passed away.
Terminated.
Right, terminated. I just don't mean all the the pleasant ones. What are the, just those. Yeah.
How about died?
Died. Yeah, we don't use that one that much, but.
How about committed or completed suicide?
Yeah, completed suicide. Final measure of devotion.
Yeah, meet your maker. We already got that.
Okay. For a while, we would. Again, this is some years ago. For a while, we used it in healthcare community. Would say that what we really need to use this word, death. That's the word we got. This is the word that we're always dancing around.
Okay.
My experience is that any of these words are euphemistic. All of these words talk about a reality that we don't really that reality at the end. Death is simply the concrete physical description of the experience. Okay. It, but it's as, it is as incomplete in describing what's happening as any of these other ones are. Okay. Asleep?
Went to meet her maker.
Meet maker? No, that's it. Yep, here it is. I miss meet maker. Yeah.
Jesus even uses the term asleep.
Sure.
And
Paul uses the term asleep. In fact, I have used when people are coming into their life sometimes and they ask, what is it like after you die? You know, what is heaven like? The scripture does not have a lot of detailed explanations about that. Sleep is often a very good image. If you get a really good night's sleep, what happens? You wake up in the morning, you feel refreshed. Do you have any sense of the time passing? No. You maybe have a dream or two or a thought or two that comes with you into the morning, but it's a very... But there's all of those, but they all tell only in part. They all have a perspective on them. They all come out. Now, if you can only use any one of them at any time, if it's the only word that you have to talk about it, it gets really limited. I mean, if you have to say kick the bucket all the time, and that's the only way, and you're having a serious conversation with somebody, and because you can't have allow yourself to have that serious conversation, you make light of it by talking about paper bucket, that's not helpful. If you have to say the word death all the time, and you're talking with someone for whom that is a very fearful thing, or they don't want to hear that word, and you keep using it, that can be not very helpful either. I'd like to offer a couple of these. I have about the same as those other ones. And if you could help me pass them on, I'd really appreciate it. Thanks. Now, these are some poems, and I would ask you to pass these back to me then. These are copyrighted poems, and I have not asked permission. And the only reason I'm passing them out is because partly I'm not a good reader. I stumble a little bit, so I would like you to look at them as I'm reading them, but I please do pass them back to me when you're done. And when you hold up reading them, read them together. There's a couple we'll read together, okay? I'm just kind of pass them out. I might not be quite have one for everybody. I wanted to start with the first one. Talking about death. And as I read it, if you want to read along, think about what is death to Edna St. Vincent Millay as she talks about the conscientious objector. What is death? I shall die, but that is all I shall do for death. I hear him leading his horse to the stall. I hear the clatter on the barn floor. He is in haste. He has business in Cuba, business in the Balkans, many calls to make this morning. But I will not hold the bridle while he clinches the girth. And he may mount by himself. I will not give him leg up. Though he flick my shoulder with the whip, I will not tell him which way the fox ran. With his hoof on my breast, I will not tell him where the black boy hides in the swamp. I shall die, but that is all I shall do for death. And I am not on his payroll. I will not tell him the whereabouts of my friends, nor my enemies either. Though he promises me much, I will not map him the route to any man's door. Am I a spy in the land of the living, that I should deliver men to death? Brother, your passwords and plans of your city are safe with me. Never through me shall you be overcome. Who's death? What's death?
The enemy.
Mm-hmm. The enemy who must be resisted. And if you're worth your salt, you will resist all the way. Now that, in some ways, is challenging in some ways in our day and age, for some, in some ways, because especially in the hospice movement, we have really embraced the idea that death is the natural process, the natural end result of life, a natural process like birth.
And isn't that different if you're 30 than if you're 70?
It is.
80 or 90?
That's true. And it depends how you die and where you die. But even if you're 30 and you die in a car accident, death is still the nat is still what happens. I mean, it's still a natural part of things. Certain things happen to my body and I will die. Okay? But it's and that image of death is very helpful, that it's a natural part of life, especially in the healthcare community where we push against it very hard. But it's not the only image. Okay? Yeah, it's not the only, there are them. In fact, the biblical image, and we'll get to this in a little bit, the biblical image is death is the result of sin. But this one, death is that thing that's coming and that we need to push against. In the hospice movement, sometimes it's really hard when we have somebody who is pushing against death. And that's what they will be doing the whole time. No, I don't really want to hear about I don't want to be in hospice because what does that mean? I'm giving up and I'm not the kind of person who gives up.
But isn't that always the person's right?
That's what I mean.
To make that choice.
Yeah.
And that's the, I think that's the power of the hospice movement. It doesn't come in and say to the person, your doctor said you are dying, therefore we're coming in and taking over and it's all downhill from here.
Right.
It really is about saying to the person, this is your life. What do you want to do with your life, not how do you want to plan your day?
It is, and that's what it's supposed to be. My experience is that is our hope of what we do in hospice. What happens is that there is a hospice way. The hospice way. Okay? And that is, in other words, yes, we want to do that, we want to be open, but the only way you get hospice is if, under these conditions, it's Medicare, funded. Medicare set it up with understanding of cancer as a primary issue. So they set it up this way. They said, here is the length of time, and here's severity. And if you've got cancer, and your physician has to say, if I ask your physician, given the normal progression of this illness process, would you be surprised if in 6 months I was died from this, given the normal progression of the illness? And if my physician would say, no, I would not be surprised if Mark was dead within 6 months, then I'm eligible for hospice. I mean, at the end of 6 months, I may have surprised my doctor and still be alive. That's okay. Then I can go for another 6 months and I might still be alive. Then I probably, as we say in our place, you would graduate from hospice. But,
what did you just say there?
You might.
In your facility, you do not say.
No. Oh, no, I said in our facility, the language used when somebody's been on hospice a long time and the physician now can no longer answer the question, okay, would you be surprised if Mark was dead? Well, I guess I would. No, I can't say that. I don't think he's going to be dead in 6 months. Okay. Then you leave hospice service. Yeah. We just call it graduating from hospice, okay? Okay. So there's, and it was all set up. It was all set up on this. You get cancer, okay? That's the course of the illness. Here's 6 months out. Okay, that's why they have the question about 6 months. So that's how they do it. People now with the ability to address issues such as chronic heart disease, diabetes, renal failure, a number of illnesses. This is just one pattern. This is a pattern for CHF, for chronic heart, for heart disease. Yeah, chronic heart disease is like this. Thank you. Congestive heart failure, CHF. Yeah, like this. And in fact, people, when they die, point of death, as often it comes here at a peak when you're doing, severity is less, you're doing well.
Mm-hmm.
He just had a great golf game, you know? Mm-hmm. It comes there as often as it comes here.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mark Buchwald is one of the graduates. Have you read his book?
No.
He was in hospice, supposed to die, and because of who he was, all these important people that knew him started coming by to visit with him and to have their last conversation with him. And it's a funny, funny book. It's good that he was chosen to write it.
Yeah.
But you should get it and read it.
I will. I will. People do that. Death is it's such an individual process, like birth. It's the severity and longevity. This is the hospice model, okay? How do you get to this hospice? This is one. I gotta back up. Why are we talking about this? Oh, because of images, because of the effect of images and how we die, how we look at it. And the hospice way, our community is talked about it as a natural, normal course, but that's not the only language that we use. We use lots of different languages. I'd like to use another one of St. Vincent de Millay's poems. I think it's not the next one, it's called Dirge Without Music. Again, now as I read it, think about what is death. What is death in? I am not resigned to the shutting away of loving hearts in the hard ground. So it is, so it will be, so it has been, time out of mind. Into the darkness they go, the wise and the lovely. Crowned with lilies and with laurel they go, but I am not resigned. Lovers and thinkers, into death, into the earth with you. Be one with the dull, with the indiscriminate dust. A fragment of what you felt, of what you knew, a formula, a phrase remains, but the best is lost. The answers, quick and keen, the honest look, the laughter, the love, they are gone. They are gone to feed the roses. Elegant and curled in is the blossom. Fragrant is a blossom, I know, but I do not approve. More precious was the light in your eyes than all the roses in the world. Down, down, down into the darkness of the grave, gentle they go, the beautiful, the tender, the kind, quietly they go, the intelligent, the witty, the brave. I know, I do not approve, but I do not approve, and I am not resigned. You feel the resistance, right? But death has a different image here. It's the dull, calm, the equalizer, the blanket that covers all things.
I think that her generation saw a lot of death. You know, death was very common. Death from influenza, death from diabetes. You know, there was no. We can see people separated from death now with the medical model. You know, so you don't see. I mean, if we see a young person die, it's a great tragedy. I know every once in a while, St. Petersburg Times, there'll be a obit for a young person. It'll be a long obit, and it'll be this, you know, about all their friends. And, you know, and it tears your heart out,
mm-hmm.
because it happens so rarely. You see a 15 or a 21-year-old or a 25-year-old. Her generation, they buried lots of their friends.
Yes.
Women died in childbirth, people died at war. I mean, death was constant in their lives. So you can see it was a constant tearing away of that, everything that they knew.
You know, it was, and again, this is just a generation, you know, basically mm-hmm. a generation before. As I read earlier, that it was death was pretty much, there was an equality about it. It took so many people out of every 10 years. I mean, it just, there was a real sense in which the young died like the old died.
Yeah.
Now, there's a sense in which we expect that death would not come. We have an expectation that death would not be there until a certain age. He died too young. She died too young. That's our expectation. Yeah. If you want to flip over that page that I gave you. At the beginning, the first part, death is when death is ordinary, commonplace, predictable, yet unpredictable, permanent, and unchangeable. All of those experiences. I asked you to flip over just a little too soon. I'm sorry, I want to flip back. Death and dying affects all of life in the most personal ways. So while we have kind of corporate images and corporate and larger ways of affect death, is ultimately most personal act. Because as a young chaplain, when I was in training, I was with a woman who was having heart disease. She was going to go down and have an open heart surgery. This is back when we did bypasses a lot more than we do now. And we had a good visit, and the physician came in to talk to her one last time. He'd been in a number of times, drawn the pictures, talked to her, did a really nice job. And then as he was leaving, he walked out the door, and he stuck his head kind of back in. He said, "Don't worry, we do this around here hundreds of times." And she looked back up without missing beats. She said, "Not on me, you don't."
Yeah. Right?
So it's my death is personal. It's a unique experience that I will be having. How do I feel about it? What would my questions about my own funeral? What would they be like? All that is to say that death also, now if you want to flip it over, death is a place of suffering. It is the place of suffering. That's where this quote really comes in. Death is a place of suffering. And I think there's two ways in which they're suffering. First, there's the suffering that takes apart. And I owe this to John Douglas Hall, who just wrote a book on suffering. Helped me think about it in more depth than I had been. There's suffering that comes about because we're human beings and because we have bodies. It's a natural kind of suffering. Because we have bodies that are created that break down. Okay? Because we're mortal, natural. And there are suffering that comes about because we make choices along the way. Because we choose to do certain things. Choices that we only partially see the meaning to. Okay? So there is the suffering that is destruction. There's suffering that is bondage. That's sin. That is when Scripture talks about death is sin. That's suffering that is refusal that we as human beings refuse to accept our finitude. And we refuse to rejoice in the fact that we have limits. Scripturally, theologically, it's basically breaking the first commandment. You shall have no other gods before you. We say, oh, okay, but, I haven't, we desire to be permanent, right? We desire our actions, instead of being able to embrace life and just celebrate it, we want to have it and hold on to it and keep it just a little longer. We refuse to accept that we have limits, that I can't actually drive my car and listen to my cell phone and put my latest CD on and get my cup of coffee at one time, right? That I can't do all that at once. We refuse to acknowledge those limits. Some are obvious, okay? The guy who comes in with lung cancer because he smoked for 75 pack years, whatever. Okay, choices, right? And some of them are less obvious, a lot less obvious. But we don't accept that we have limits. And the other form of suffering that is bondage, one is our refusal to accept our limits. The other is just is a tragic set of circumstances and events. You could be driving down the road, doing everything right, and something car comes out of blue and hits you and you don't see it coming and you're gone. Earthquake, those kinds of things. Situations get set up. Things happen to us And actually, in the discussions we had just had a little earlier today about insurance contracts, there are acts of things that happen that we don't have control over. Those are the kinds of things that take us apart. Sin, the human history that we have, that we talk about, our inability to.
Is our generation or our current age prolonging suffering more so than the previous generation when we did not have all this medicine available to us? My eyes has seen a lot of suffering, and I think because of the medical things that are out there, because we're living longer, there's more opportunity for a whole lot more suffering.
It's really an interesting question. The healthcare community has really alleviated an immense amount of suffering. There's no question about that. With the ability to cure diseases that took people's lives regularly, there's an amazing amount of suffering that we have. Polio is a great example. There's so much we've been able to do. Okay? At the same time, there's so much suffering that has come because we have been so successful in what we do. It's a very human interest, it's very powerful that how those two things flow together. One is we've really allowed people to live a lot longer, a lot, lot longer than they ever did before in human history. Evolutionary, we didn't live that long, and if you live a lot longer, then things like cancer have much more opportunity to become established. The cells replicate a lot more, and it's in the replication of those cells often that the mistakes get made that develop cancer. So there's more suffering. So I don't know. I don't have an answer to that question. Clearly, I wouldn't want to go back to where we were. that would not be a good place to be. To have to worry about my kids or my whole family being wiped out by an illness process that came through, when hopefully we'll be able to manage that better now. But on the other hand, there's an immense amount of suffering that happens when people get older too. It's hard. It's really hard to know. Yeah.
I had a friend once who, very close friend, who has a relative, and she asked me if she could put me in her living will.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I have to let you know my philosophy since my early 20s has changed, and I look for meaning in suffering. And so she took the offer, and she was a friend of mine. When my father died, she was with us, with the family, and I know that we caused my dad to probably live a few more weeks, and I even called sister to say goodbye. And I know part of the suffering that he continued a little more is because we were just so crazy about it. Now, of course, he didn't die alone. He had a community around him. And my mother is 80 now. She's had bypass and pig valve replacement. And I'm an enthusiasm one. I keep telling her your life story is so, and she's with the game so far, but eventually I gotta give up. I can't be so pushy that I don't let them release. And I think if you can get to that point, that's a beautiful thing in and of itself, but we also need to back off. I think you had a good point over there.
It comes to this, we like almost like so many of human endeavors, we can't see the consequences of our actions completely. We just can't see it. So we do the best we can in the midst of it. In healthcare, suffering has been seen as the thing we have to alleviate and stop. That's what inspires people to become doctors, is they want to help people who are suffering, right? We put suffering. So it is hard to address the suffering that comes afterwards, because then we have to face it as suffering. But I want to say that the first kind of suffering is bondage. That is bondage that takes things apart. But there is a suffering that is freedom. There is a suffering that is associated with becoming. And if you read Genesis text carefully, there was suffering before the fall. People suffered before the fall, before the sin. Okay? What kind of suffering was in terms of loneliness? Adam suffered, he was alone. He was all alone. Okay? That's suffering before sin we're talking about. This is suffering of loneliness. Without loneliness, we have no need for relationships. And if I have no loneliness, I don't care about other people. Loneliness is connected with relationships, our need for relationships. It's called love, right? Limits. There are limits that we have to face. Suffering. When suffering, we face our limits. Sometimes when we suffer and face our limits, we can pull back and we can, and we're better people for it. We can help other people out when we face those limits, some of those limits.
You know, when you talk about doing a lot of meditation at the end of life to cut off suffering, I keep wondering about that. Is that cutting off suffering or is it changing the suffering? You know, is it changing it from a physical kind of suffering to an emotional kind of suffering, both for the family and for the individual, so that communication is lost, so that, you know, so there may be less physical pain, but then the family can no longer communicate because the brain just isn't functioning well enough to communicate. Is that not its own kind of suffering?
It is, and that's a very complex question. I mean, we struggle with that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
How much pain medication, how much, the family doesn't want dad to be in pain anymore, so they'd like to increase the pain medication. What does dad want? How do we do it? How much can... Those are real struggles, and we suffer. And if we could acknowledge our suffering, then we have to work on doing that kind of conversation and figuring that out better. I mean, suffering isn't a bad thing necessarily. It can be something that we can grow, that can lead us to grow and to change. Suffering
To what extent does the medical profession or all of us ask someone how much they want to suffer or what kind of process they would prefer, rather than saying, oh, well, we're going to give you this now?
It's a great question, and it's really difficult to do. There have been a number of studies done on those kinds of things. Physicians, one study showed that an uncomfortably large number, over 40% of physicians, would wait until the patient was not conscious and then ask the family. It's really a hard thing to do. It's really hard to know how to ask that question. What does that mean? You ask me, do I want to suffer? No, I don't want to. I mean, you don't want to suffer. Do I want to be able to have a conversation with my family? Yes, I do. How much pain would that be? Are my conversations with my family painful enough so that I want to avoid those? It's a very difficult question to answer. In our healthcare community, physicians are not trained in asking those questions. And we don't reward physicians for asking those questions. And many physicians are not there because they want to ask those kinds of questions. Physicians are trained, you get to be a physician when you go through a long process and you have to be very good at what you do and you have to be a very good detective, basically. I mean, that's my image. Detective. You have clues and you get the clues and you keep working on it until you figure out the answer for it. And then after years of doing it, your sense of intuition helps you. I had a good friend who went in, he had a physical, and he wasn't really in great shape anyway, but he was okay. And all he mentioned to his physician was that he just had this weird burpy thing that happened every time he had a cucumbers these days. And it was just really kind of weird. And the physician said, what? And he started asking more questions. And well, they found out that he had a growth near his gallbladder that had to be removed, right? From that one question, well, it's because the physician was really good, and he knew his patient well enough that when he said that, it wasn't just, okay, it was like, you know, but he was, so we reward people who really do that really well. okay? I wouldn't make a good physician. You wouldn't want me as a surgeon. You'd say, okay, it's time for surgery. Okay, let's go to surgery. Well, maybe we should talk about it a little. I don't know. What do you think? What do you guys think? Should we have surgery? You don't want that with a surgeon. You want a surgeon to say, we need to have surgery. And I know it's right, we need to have surgery. And with enough humility to be able to say, but so it's very hard for physicians to ask those kinds of questions.
But I think, personally, I'd still like to know what the pros and cons are.
Absolutely.
What the costs
absolutely.
Of surgery are in terms of,
absolutely.
There's always cost in any kind of treatment.
Absolutely.
I don't know what I'm choosing.
One of the tragedies of our system is that we have, I think, we have given over the discussion of mortality, life and death, over to physicians.
Yes.
We've said they're the ones who understand and know this stuff. They'll bring it up. They'll talk to me when it's time. My doctor will bring it up. Okay? And because we do that generally, and physicians for the most part don't like to have those conversations. No, who likes that? They don't want to have a conversation. They don't feel comfortable in those conversations. As a hospice, a chaplain, and an acute care setting, I have been at hundreds of deaths. We've been there when people have taken their last breath. I've only been there when physicians have been there.
Mm-hmm.
I've only been there once when a physician chose to be at the bedside when the death happened. The other one, the physician didn't have a choice. Right, I mean, not really. Okay? Now, that may be a unique experience, but what it says, and it doesn't, and always the rejoinder is, well, it's too hard for physicians. If they had to do that for everybody, it would be too hard emotionally on them. Okay? Well, at first I said that, but it just doesn't fit. Because it's not like physicians have patients, where I come from, have patients dying every day or every week even. They have, you know, it's part of the process. But there's something that gets in the way of that, okay? That's part of what we struggle with in our country in death and dying. That's part of what makes it so difficult, is that our conversations about death tend to happen in places like this, away from that, those healthcare communities. We need to kind of bring them in.
My four daughters have decided they want the conversation after I die, that at the memorial service. So this is really quite serious.
Yeah.
They have asked me to write the meditation.
Oh, yeah.
My own meditation for my memorial service.
How's that going?
Well, I haven't started. Oh, no, actually, it sort of stimulated the discussion because I said to them, well, what do you expect I might say?
Yeah.
And so now we're having a conversation. Right. Hope, the first thing I said was, do you know something I don't know?
That's right. Why are we talking about it?
But anyway, it has stimulated a discussion about death issues. And I don't know when I'll get started on it. And, but we're talking about it.
Yeah. And that our conversation, the conversation that we have right now over this week, the conversations that you have with people about death, they are conversations that shape how you live. Okay, that's the bottom line. The bottom for me is that death and how death is shapes so much of how we live. And because we have such a hard time in our culture having conversations about our own dying, about what we would like it to be like, people don't know how to respond when we come to that place. I can tell you partly how I'd like my dying to be. I'd like people around me to love me. I don't really want to die, if it's possible, I don't really want to die with just mostly strangers around me. I want to die with people who really care for me around me. And it's okay if they cry. Have a good cry. I think in my mind, I'll think, oh, I mattered to them. That's good. That's okay. You can cry. I had value and worth. You loved me. You cared for me. I cared for you too. So that's okay. There can be emotion around there because I know that that's going to pass. And I don't want to die with a in excruciating pain so that I cannot be a part of my family's life. When I can't be a part of their lives in a meaningful way, when no one can I interact with them in ways that has kind of meaning that I'm used to in life, well, then that's when I'm going to be with the Lord. That's the Lord calling me home, folks. Okay? So I have some of those things and those ideas, those kinds of conversations. When we can have those kinds of conversations, that's what really helps people. So that when you come to the end about suffering, about when to stop or what to do, we have a context in which to say, you know, Dad would just come back and kick me in the butt if I did that. or, you know, Dad would want to try it. He'd want to try it. He really would. I don't know. If it doesn't work, we can, you know. But Dad was that kind of guy. You know, oh, it's new technology? Never done it before? That's Dad. Let's give it a try. Because that's, you know, he was always on the cutting edge of things. But those kinds of, if we have those conversations, they help people afterwards. And we over the time. If you'd like to get up and leave, feel free to do so after. I have one more point. Actually, I've got two. They're very brief, and I believe they're both in that packet. The first one is from Rainer Rilke. Just actually a couple. It's just a verse. Verse out of the book, you mentioned about that one. It starts with God. God gives each of us our own death, the dying that proceeds from each of our lives, the way we love, the meanings we made, our meaning. And then one from Emily Dickinson. Emily Dickinson is just amazing to me. You have to chew on it and chew on it usually. And then after a while, it just fits. So, death is a dialogue between the spirit and the dust. Dissolve, says death. The spirit, sir, I have another trust. Death doubts it, argues from the ground. The spirit turns away, just laying off evidence, an overcoat of clay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.